Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Hitesh Hathi, and this is a special hour of Radio Boston. We're reflecting on 2018 by listening back to our producer's favorite segments, including IP theft from a local company.
It's like a Tom Clancy novel or any kind of spy versus spy type arrangement where they offer them money, they offer women, they offer them a different life.
Also today, how ex-cons can restart their lives.
What happens when you make a mistake and you're a simple guy and you just want to come home and live a clean life? Oftentimes, you don't get a chance to because of what comes with being an ex-criminal.
Plus, we visit Boston's first robot restaurant.
What you're listening to here, that's the sound of our chicken and rice searing and sizzling in the robotic wok.
And arts, culture, and bad music covers.
You just can't do something that bad to a song that great.
Producer's Picks are next on Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Hitesh Hathi. I'm the executive producer of the program. I'm here for this special hour with the entire Radio Boston team, wishing you a happy new year. Say happy new year, everyone.
Happy new year, Hitesh.
Okay, so you've just been listening to Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell.
Hello.
Paris Alston.
Bonjour.
Chris Sitterick.
Howdy.
Jamie Bologna.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno, Jamie. And behind the glass over there, we have Eve Zukoff, and we have Tim Skoke, our technical director.
Hey, Tim.
So, listeners, we want to begin this year with a kind of reflection because it's been a year of a lot of change and excitement for Radio Boston. First of all, as most of you know, what am I going to say next, everyone?
Something about a host.
A host.
Something about some amazing hires.
Amazing hires. So our host, Meghna Chakrabarty, as most of you know, has moved over about, 100 feet down the hall to an exciting new gig with our sister show On Point. Kind of a loss for us, but there have been three gains. Three of the four producers you just heard from are new.
So that would be me, Zoe.
Zoe is our newest producer.
But I've been around the block a few times.
Yes. So, Paris, you joined us 6 months ago?
8 months.
8 months ago. And Chris Sitterick.
I started at the end of March.
At the end of March, which leaves Jamie Bologna, the grizzled...
What would we do without Jamie Bologna?
Yes.
So it's a year of change and it's a year of growth for the show. We've been trying out a bunch of guest hosts and we'll have, I hope, early in the new year, some kind of announcement about a permanent host for the program, which will be an exciting new development. I want to say it's been wonderful to be receiving feedback from all of you about things we've been trying. One of them is more voices from the producing staff on air. And now it's on to today's program. It's a special hour of producers' picks, which means...
We picked the show out, I guess.
Yeah, we did. We picked all our favorites.
So it's like our favorite segments that we produced.
So let's start with the first one, Paris Alston.
Yes, so it's been really fun being with the Radio Boston team for these several months. And one thing that I've really enjoyed about what we do here every day is we often get to speak to people who are on the ground making an impact in their communities. And they really often bring us a perspective that we don't always get to get because they're up close and personal with some really interesting people. And one of those people is Imam Taymullah Abdurrahman, who grew up in Boston and he went on to become the Muslim chaplain at Harvard University. And now he's the imam for the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. And also, excitingly, he is the host of the podcast X Conversations.
So X Conversations, get it? X Conversations.
Wow.
That's right, yes. X Conversations.
Okay, I can't help punning. Sorry, everyone.
X Conversations is a podcast where Taymullah brings us these very rich and really personal conversations with ex-offenders who are out of prison and they're trying to stay on the right track. WBUR's Anthony Brooks actually told us about this podcast and I went on to produce this segment and it was a conversation between Anthony and Taymullah where they talked about the podcast. And what I really loved about their conversation is that it allowed us to look at criminal justice from a different perspective.
Here's an excerpt from
X Conversations. Episode 3, you talked to David DePina. He's also known as Crunchy in the street, right? He was shot in two separate incidents. Several of his friends were murdered. He ends up serving more than a decade for murder on gun charges. So here's Crunchy talking about a big moment in his life. He was about to graduate from high school, but he was running around with some tough characters, got busted for carrying drugs, and his high school principal called him in to give him some bad news.
He was like, listen, I have to expel you. So I'm like, you let this guy stay in school. He got caught with drugs. And I was like, yeah, whatever. I was like, why? Because he's white and I'm black. Mm.
So looking back, you're a teenager. You're kind of a knucklehead.
Right.
Is it his fault or is it your fault?
It's absolutely my fault. Okay. 100% it's my fault. Because it's my fault because I gave him that perception. Mm. That's all he can go by is what I showed him at the end of the day.
I'm trying to get David to see things through the lens of his high school principal. It's easy to demonize the white administrator who seems cold and racist, but it's not always so simple, and it's not always about race.
So, Tay, tell me a little bit about this story of David DePina. What's profound about this story? What did you want? Why did you want to feature him?
Well, I think when you meet David, he is, I mean, surprisingly, very gentle, sweet guy. You wouldn't imagine him to be in any kind of trouble, right? He looks like he's 18 years old. He's in his mid-30s, first and foremost. He grew up in a two-parent household. They were both... both of his parents were addicted to drugs. He got ran in with the wrong crowd. And basically, through these incidents in his neighborhood, he got in a shootout and someone was killed. Hmm. While he's in the county jail awaiting trial for murder, he gets a call that his mother has been murdered. Hmm. And evidently, it was revenge for the crime he committed. So he's in there dealing with facing a life sentence. Now he's reeling over the guilt of possibly, you know, being directly responsible for his mother or indirectly responsible for his mother's death. So his story is really about, you know, how do you deal with that over a period of 10 years or so? How do you come home and pick up the pieces, ask for forgiveness, and try to move on and raise, you know, his daughter?
Is that the process he's in the middle of? I mean, is he asking for forgiveness? Is that what he wanted to do? Is that part of the challenge he's facing?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a guy who's deeply remorseful about, you know, the lives lost on, you know, that he was responsible for, as well as, you know, of course, his mom. But he's trying to pay it forward through being in his daughter's life, like full time. You know, this guy's really a great dad. And I think that's part of the story is that, you know, these people are coming home whether we like it or not. And we should know that, you know, for the most part, they're mostly successful guys. What about their stories? We hear about the negative stories, but what about the guys who come home and they're good fathers and good husbands and good employees and good citizens?
Yeah, and I want to ask you a little bit about the challenges that these folks face, especially the people who have really made a decision to leave the old life behind and want to create a new life.
Right.
And it's not always so straightforward. It's not, you can't just sort of make a change in your heart and say, I'm going to make this change, because you've got this sort of burden of that previous life. Right?
Exactly. I mean, first and foremost, the podcast is not about making these guys into victims.
Right.
That's important, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you commit a crime, you have to pay your debt to society. But the podcast says, okay, what if a guy has owned up to his crime, paid his debt, and now he's home? Doesn't he get a second chance?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And what happens when he's becomes a prisoner after prison through, you know, the Corey records and all of his, you know, all of the boxes and stigmatizing that comes with being an ex-con. So for him and guys like him, there's so many challenges. Once you get a job and they find out your background, you know, then they begin to exploit you for long hours and, you know, different shifts you don't want to take and, you know, talk to you any kind of way. So there's so many levels of demoralizing in the process of their reformation or repentance.
So there's a good example of this, another conversation you have with a guy named Orlando Cruz. So
right.
When he was a kid in Boston, he shot three of his friends during a dispute. He served six months in a youth facility for that.
Right.
But then got out and went to law school and he became a lawyer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, but at a certain point, the law school confronts him and accuses him of not filling out his application honestly because he didn't reveal that he'd been arrested. So let's listen to a bit of that.
Cool.
I would not have lied about that. On my application, it wasn't on it. It asked if I had been convicted of a felony. I've been charged with all kind of stuff now. but I wasn't convicted of a felony.
Amazing.
My personal statement told you who I was, mm-hmm. where I came from, who I am today. I wasn't living a certain lifestyle. I mean, why would you disqualify me at this point?
So it's a great question. Mm. And things worked out pretty well for him.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
But that story he tells, and you made reference to the Corey records and stuff, I mean, this is a really hard set of baggage, essentially, indeed, to shed if you're trying to turn your life around.
Indeed. I mean, it's almost, they're up against insurmountable odds, right? And if you do anything as a youth, that's going to carry, you know, even though they say it doesn't, it carries with you wherever you go. And if you're not able to, Orlando was even almost on the brink of, you know, having his chances swept from under him, mm-hmm. you know, in that confrontation. But if you're not a guy like Orlando, who's thoughtful, intelligent, and charismatic, and has all of those great charms and gifts, then what happens when you make a mistake and you're a simple guy and you just want to come home and live a clean life? Oftentimes, you don't get a chance to because of what comes with being an ex-criminal.
So what's the fix there?
The fix there, honestly, I believe is, you know, you got to look at criminal justice reform.
Yeah.
You got to look at some of the policies that are out right now, you know, and trying to really reform. When guys come home, give them a chance. I mean, when they're in prison, they're able to do great things and attend college. But if they're able to come home and utilize those credentials, then that's what's great. But if they're not, then it's just a piece of paper.
Right. And what would be sort of on the top of your list of the sort of the next thing that needs to happen?
I think the next thing that needs to happen is looking at sentencing, because what happens is, you know, a guy could commit a crime when he's 19, 20 years old, and he has to sit for his natural life.
Yeah.
And so what happens when the brain is not even formed? I'm not the same guy I was 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
So now you're 45, you're a different person, and your life is over. You know, that's tough to accept. Again, it's really just looking at lowering that age so that you can say, look, people who are of a certain age, let's take into account that they shouldn't have natural life without the chance of parole.
Tay, one of the things, I think the thing that I love most about your podcast is you're a really good listener. You know, they say, what's the trick of interviewing people well and getting people to express themselves on the radio? And it's really simple. It's listening. Mm. And you listen really, really
thank you,
well.
Andrew.
No, it's
thank
really
you.
Clear.
Thank you,
but
bro.
It makes me ask, how do these stories relate to your life?
Right. I mean, honestly, I feel so much, I feel akin to these stories because I'm from the bottom. You know, socially and economically, I come from Roxbury. So, I mean, I have family and friends who are deeply involved in you know, situations like this. And I grew up around these type of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to be able to humanize them, right? I want to be able to deter young people with these stories, humanize them for adults, but also give hope to those who are incarcerated now that when you come home, you do have an opportunity to change.
That's pretty riveting.
Yeah.
Powerful, yeah.
And you know what struck me so much about this? There's so many different worlds. There isn't one Boston, one Eastern Massachusetts. You know, people are living these separate lives, mm-hmm. and part of what's exciting and a privilege for us is to be able to bring these different stories to light.
Exactly, and that's part of our jobs. That's what we're put here to do every single day.
Well, I think it's fair to say that's why we're mostly here, right?
Yeah.
That's the raw excitement of it.
Yeah. The WBR swag helps.
Okay. Paris, thank you very much for bringing us that.
Thank you. And thank you, Anthony and Taymula, for bringing us that conversation.
Stay with us. This is Radio Boston. I'm Hitesh Hathi. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Hitesh Hathi. You aren't used to hearing my voice. I'm the executive producer, but I'm here today because we're doing a special show. Producers Picks. Producers are here with me in the studio.
We're still here.
Hi. That was Zoe Mitchell.
Hello.
Paris Alston is also
still
here.
Still hanging on.
Chris Sitterick.
Ready to rock.
And Jamie Bologna.
How can you miss me if I never go away?
Yes. I'm really glad you're not going away. So we're starting the new year by looking back at some of the things we've done last year. Producers have picked their favorites. And Chris, you're up next.
So for me, there was one segment that definitely jumped to mind as the most memorable. And it actually came from very early on. I believe it was my second week here. We were looking as a team for a way to talk about IP theft, intellectual property theft. It was very big in the national conversation. President Trump was talking a lot about it. We're looking for a local way to talk about IP theft, which seems like this big kind of nebulous idea. And in doing some research, I stumbled across this just cloak and dagger story that's almost too insane to believe. But it really did happen to this Massachusetts-based company. The company's called American Superconductor, and we talked with their CEO, Daniel McGann. They had decided they wanted to do business in China. They knew where there were some serious risks to that, so they took a lot of steps to protect their intellectual property and their specifically their operating system for their wind turbines. And yet, once they started doing business in China, one of their employees, a Serbian national who was working in Austria, was actually recruited and flipped by Chinese workers and basically stole the technology from this company, gave it to this Chinese company, Sinovel. He actually was apprehended by Austrian authorities, so it didn't work out so well for him.
But it also tells us about what kind of crazy world we're living in. Eastern Europeans being turned by Chinese, by promises. You know, intelligence going on from all sides.
Absolutely. And let's take a listen to Daniel McGann tell us this unbelievable story that, again, I can't stress enough, this really did happen.
They had 800 R&D engineers trying to reverse engineer everything we could do. They were unsuccessful in doing that, and they had to resort to outright theft to get what they wanted.
It's almost unbelievable, but it happened. So you partnered with this company, Sinovel, this Chinese company, and they somehow turned one of your European contractors?
Yeah. So think about how big this got. So they went and they became number one in China by 2008 and number two in the world. They were bigger than General Electric by 2009. They liked the technology so much that they wanted it all. So they coerced. They used, spycraft era type, it's like a Tom Clancy novel, or any kind of spy versus spy type arrangement where they offered them money, they offered them women, they offered them a different life.
This is a contractor in Austria.
This is a direct employee.
Direct employee, that's right.
Right. So he's a Serbian national working in Austria. He's already been tried, convicted. He confessed to the crime.
He confessed to the crime, yeah.
And they basically had set up a whole new life for him in Beijing that he was unable to get to because we were able to work with Austrian authorities to catch him.
I mean, there's text messages that have been shown that he said he wanted women and money, and they were ready to give him $1.7 million, and they were really buttering him up. And so what did he end up giving them?
What he did, and he was kind of smart about it, which helps us, he was able to transfer some of the outer source code at the turbine level. But at our hardware controller, what he did is he recompiled new versions. So if we do this by analogy, like Windows, there used to be Windows 3.1. So imagine like Windows 3.4 shows up. There was never Windows 3.4. So you see this new version that he turned off this encryption. He added some features that were being tested and tried out in China at the time. And that's how we knew. There was a wind farm that was operating. The turbines were still spinning. We had put in code to turn it off by a certain time. They continued to operate beyond that time window. And we knew there was an issue at that point.
That's just amazing. It's amazing, right?
We tried to put in every piece of protection we could think of. And I think, the fact that they actually had to resort to spycraft and theft to get what they wanted proves that the level of protection was probably more sophisticated than most industrial products that go into China.
Oh, so he admits the crime. He does a year in jail.
He confessed. Right. Okay. He got sentenced 3. I think he had a year plus time served.
Okay. But, I mean, we still have Sinovel, this massive company.
And we still have about 20% of the fleet of all the wind turbines in China that are owned by the Chinese government still operating under stolen code.
To this day?
To this day.
Your stolen code?
Yes.
What has this cost your company?
Well, it cost shareholders in about a day almost $1 billion. The damages we're seeking in China are to the tune of $1.2 billion. The damages that the U.S. Department of Justice have ascribed to this, so they related this to akin to attempted corporate homicide. The Wall Street Journal reported damages of $4.8 billion. So it's a big number regardless of what you look at.
There's one more layer of the mind-boggling nature of the lengths that China went to get your technology because – Do I remember the chronology right? Even after that former employee had admitted to his crimes, that a branch of the Chinese military performed a successful spear phishing attack on your company to get even more IP? Or
yeah, there was other technology around wind that they didn't get. We knew that they didn't get. They knew they didn't get, and they were trying to find a way to get additional technology through means through the PLA.
Okay. the Chinese military.
Charming, yeah.
All right. So in 2016, you talked to 60 Minutes, and there's a scene where you're walking through your manufacturing facility and it's empty. And at that point in time, you had said that you had to lay off some 300 people.
It was almost 700.
Almost 700 people.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I got the numbers backward. Right, right. Almost 700 out of roughly 900 you had employed at that time. Give me some good news.
So the good news is, are things going better now? We took what we learned in China. What we were selling was basically the operating system, the software, and a pallet of parts, and then allow them to make their end control system on their own. We don't allow customers to do that anymore. We do it all ourselves. We do end-to-end. But that's only a piece of our business. We made a strategic decision to diversify into making the grid more resilient, allowing it to work with more resiliency, and making the U.S. Navy more resilient, surface ships from mines and minefields.
Great. It's good to hear, because there's one more part of the story of what happened to American Superconductor that I just have to touch on, because it's so, I mean, it's like, it's where the rub is, right? That you had your Massachusetts company, you have your technology stolen by China, and yet there is a wind turbine in the state of Massachusetts running that stolen technology?
Right. So there are a few of them, and that's the evidence that went into the U.S. Department of Justice case against the Chinese, which we got a criminal conviction
in January.
Just in January, and sentencing is scheduled to occur.
But taxpayer dollars were used to buy one of
taxpayer dollars. So if you go back to the beginning of Obama and TARP and stimulus money was used for federal taxpayers to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to purchase wind turbines that had stolen software from a Massachusetts company.
That is head smacking, I have to say. A couple more quick questions for you, Dan. You've been so generous in sharing your story here. So you mentioned that, yes, in January there was a decision by a federal jury in this DOJ case against Sinovel, the company that you had partnered with in China, and they found that, yes, Sinovel did steal your trade secrets. And U.S. Attorney Scott Blader says of that January conviction, again, of this year, that it sends a strong and clear message to the that the theft of ideas and ingenuity is not a business dispute. It's a crime and will be prosecuted as such. How important do you think that verdict is?
We think it's critical, because what it does is it puts this administration on the hook, and you can see it in the daily events today. We're talking about trade issues with China. Front and center is our issue with its intellectual property. And ultimately what they're after is, we've tried and convict you in our courts. We want the Chinese system to work. If you're a member of WTO, you need to have your laws work and these mechanisms to be able to protect IP. Xi Jinping himself has come out very strongly saying we need to punish the wrongdoers that steal intellectual property. And our case is kind of the poster child for really testing, does the Chinese system allow for protection of these intellectual property rights from Western companies?
So finally, let me ask you then, what do you think of the fact that it's the Trump administration that has imposed these tariffs, perhaps as a lever to do exactly what you're saying? It didn't happen under the Obama administration. Do you think these tariffs are a good step or not?
It's certainly different. So to evaluate if it's good or bad, I got to focus on the outcome and see what comes of it. I know, you know, because we were very much involved with then Secretary Kerry and then Secretary Clinton and all the Obama administration up to six cabinet level officials and the vice president. Every 6 months, there is negotiated economic diplomacy between the countries. And I can say that obviously didn't work. Scheduling these dialogues didn't allow these issues to get resolved. So maybe this unscheduled, whatever this is that we're going through, will help at least bring the sides to the table and realize that both sides can win on this issue.
So, Chris, it was such a complicated story. You saw the levels at which it went. But it also shows that fear of intellectual property theft, it's so real, and the consequences are so real for actual companies and actual workers.
Oh, absolutely. And as you heard him say in the piece, experts estimate that this company lost over $1 billion in value overnight. I have to say, though, my favorite detail of the whole thing was the Shyamalan-esque twist where Massachusetts actually bought wind turbines that used this stolen material from a Massachusetts company. Just the icing on the cake. Unbelievable.
And I love this story, too. And this was your second week here. It's like, Chris Sidorek's just getting started.
What do you see what I got for 2019?
2019, I'm really looking forward to it. Next up, it's Zoe.
Hello.
Hi, Zoe Mitchell.
Again.
I should say hello again. And I know it's Zoe, so I
very curious about what you have up for us, Zoe, because it's always out of the box.
It's been so serious so far.
I know. I was going to say, everybody settle in, get comfortable.
Yes. That's what I've been waiting for.
So I know we cover a lot of really serious topics on this show, but you know, as we go into the new year, I wanted to play some of my more favorite arts and culture moments.
Like
clip
show?
Yeah.
How dare you reduce this to that?
Which is fitting, because Zoe's like our arts and culture ambassador.
Yeah.
So, and I want to start with Eighth Grade. It was a film out this year by Bo Burnham. He's a Massachusetts native. He was this huge YouTube star around the times that I was in middle school.
And I have to say, I had never heard of him, really. But you came to me and you explained it. I said, we've got to do this.
Yeah,
I don't know if you want to brag about that.
Yeah. I wasn't bragging. I was actually looking abashed.
Yeah. And I came to you specifically. I was a huge fan of his when he was a huge YouTube star. I loved the film. I think it says so much about who we are as young people and growing up in today's like modern tech environment. And when Anthony Brooks spoke with him in June and I produced this segment, went and saw the movie, there was a moment in the interview where I actually came up. So yes, we are going to begin with me.
So I was talking to my very great producer, Zoe, who's your age, and she said that something really interesting about this film, that it's really the only one that depicts in a real way how young people are using the internet and social media. And given how prevalent all this is in our society, why is that? I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, there are not a lot of films out there that really delve into it the way you have.
Yeah, that's nice. Well, thank you, Zoe.
Yeah, that's me.
That's Zoe that's, Mitchell, that's Radio Boston producer.
That's my favorite celebrity when I was 13. So I'm sorry to start with the fangirling. I don't normally do that over who we're interviewing, but, you know, it's an exception. It's the new year, et cetera. Anyway, I just want to say to hear the answer to that question and more about the movie, I'd refer you to RadioBoston.org. Listen back to our fabulous December 26th program produced by Paris Alston that looks back on the movies of 2018. That was last week. Moving right along, another thing I really love about working on Radio Boston is the collaboration we all have as a team and how we really do work together so closely on everything to get the show on air. As Hitesh said before, we did lose a member of that team this year. That was Meghna Chakrabarty. And I just wanted to say that she was one of the most passionate, hardworking, and dedicated people that I know. I learned so much from her. And at the same time, as we're about to hear, she still was always game to have a little fun, as you can hear we all are.
Of course she was.
And I love that in her final month with us, we did this song, this segment that was cover songs, the best and worst of all time. And there was this moment about one of those quote-unquote worst songs that I could not go through a producer's picks and not play.
You mentioned Taylor Swift, because she did a cover of September. Let's play the original version here, if we can. Do you guys have it? Here it is. Okay, obviously everybody knows and loves that song. And here's what Taylor Swift did it in a cover from April of this year. Again, it's the cover of Earth, Wind, and Fire's September. This is Taylor Swift. Radio and not Melissa Ferrick's face.
I don't even.
Did you just give me a what just
no,
happened?
No, I'm just so glad I've never heard that before. I'm so glad that I've been on the planet for however long it's been since she put this out and didn't ever hear it. I mean, that
but
is
what's
just
wrong with it? I mean, look,
I mean everything. There's
come on.
I just don't. You just can't do something that bad to a song that great. I mean, there's no emotional. I guess I get stuck on the emotional connection between the performance of it and like the lyric content. There's just nothing that's a. I don't feel anything when Taylor Swift's this, besides the banjo situation.
Well, when I heard it, my first five questions were, is that a banjo?
Right.
Is that a banjo? Why is there a banjo there? But Ray Padgett, I mean, on the other hand, you know, she's not trying to copy the original, so.
She sure isn't.
So, Zoe, as you know, I'm not a big pop culture guy, but even I can tell the difference. It's a sad difference.
You know, and I think you can hear the joy kind of that Megna and the guests have in really kind of dissecting that difference. And that was just a really fun kind of way, I think, to send Megna out. Anyway, so now on to my final and actual producer pick.
I feel like you're gaming the system.
Anyway, so, said, it is my time.
You told me I have 10 minutes. I have 10 minutes.
Okay.
So it's been two appetizers, everyone. Here comes the entree.
Here comes the entree. I want to remember the first full piece that I did for the show myself, where I actually got to get out into the world of Boston, and I interviewed a very young, very up-and-coming actor in town for his final performance in a role that was written for him. He was playing Shakespeare's mysterious only son, who we know very little about. The play is called Hamnet, and when it had its U.S. premiere at the Paramount Theater this past fall, I got to go and speak with this young Irish actor as he prepared for his final night in the role.
Let's listen.
14-year-old Ollie West is alone on stage for almost all of the hour-long production. On the wall behind him, there is a video screen that projects a mirror of his actions. At the start of the play, Hamnet wears a light blue hoodie, sneakers, and a backpack too big for his small frame. In his first lines, he strikes up a conversation with the audience, hoping that his famous father may be sitting among them.
My mom said I'm not allowed to talk to strangers because you never know who they might be. So don't talk to them. But I said to her, if I don't talk to strangers, then I'll never meet my dad. So, hello. Dad? Are you there?
Hamnet asked the audience how a person deals with loss, whether that loss is the absence of a father or the death of a child. Those are some pretty heavy questions for West, who's been leading the production since he was 11 years old. With a final few performances left to go, because he's looking and sounding too old for the role, West says he's just starting to understand some of the answers.
At the beginning when I did it, I didn't really think about Hamnet, and I just kind of said the words for a depressed character, and that's what my thought of Hamnet was at the beginning, but then I kind of like got it, and he's like, I don't know, I just kind of started figuring out the story, and now I kind of know what everything means at the last few shows.
Born in 1585, little is known about the short life of the actual Hamnet. He lived in Stratford-upon-Avon with his mother and his twin sister, Judith. The siblings did not have a relationship with their famous father, who left them to pursue a career in London. As the play goes on, we learn more about the strange world where this theatrical 11-year-old Hamnet exists.
He doesn't know he's dead, and the whole play is about him kind of figuring it out. I guess a little bit kind of knows. He just doesn't really want to believe it.
West says he does not want his performance to be perceived as too dramatic or over the top when confronting the difficult relationship between father and son.
Is this what you imagined I'd look like?
Don't know.
Oh, this is what I look like.
I thought you were supposed to be a great man.
I am.
You just look like a man.
I'll prove my greatness to you. Ask me anything.
Why did you go away?
During the most emotional scene of the play, Hamnet does finally come face to face with his father.
Shakespeare slaps me and I fall on the ground, and I have to like cry. And then, so I don't know, I don't really actually cry. I kind of just make a weird moany voice. I didn't want to overact.
West has traveled all over the world with this production, but now he looks forward to handing over the role to 11-year-old actor Aaron Murphy, who is also from Ireland.
When I first heard that another kid, I was pretty happy. Like, I'm kind of glad it's like continuing on, and I am getting a little old for this character. And I met Aaron, and he's a pretty cool kid.
He does have some advice for his successor.
I told Aaron that once you're like behind stage, and then you like hear the audience come in, and you're like about to go on, you like you need to go to the toilet. You, like, immediately just, you need to just, you know. but then when once you get on, then it's like, it's gone. Once you hear, like, the audience laugh, it's like, whew.
You know, Zoe, I remember us working on that piece together, and you really, he was very young and maybe even reserved, but you really got him to say some things that were very real and meaningful, to reflect, you know, in a way that's maybe not so usual for kids that young.
Yeah, thank you. It was kind of an interesting challenge for one of my first Radio Boston produced pieces, was getting him to really open up, so...
So there you are. That's Zoe Mitchell, everyone. Thank you, Zoe.
I'm done. Thank you, guys.
No, this has been great. I love that. Hearing Zoe. More Zoe in 2019.
More Zoe in 2019.
Thanks, Perry.
And stay with us. There's more coming up. I'm Hitesh Hathi. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Hitesh Hathi. I'm the executive producer of the program. You're not used to hearing me, but it's a special hour to begin the new year. And with me here are all the producers for Radio Boston. Zoe Mitchell.
Hello.
Paris Alston.
Hi, everybody.
Chris Sitterick.
Still here.
And Jamie Bologna.
Hello again.
Jamie, as we said earlier, is the grizzled veteran in his youth.
You know,
he's really leaning into that grizzle.
Say, okay, so there's like... We use Slack here in the office, and there's a Slack channel for the young people called the Whippersnappers. And I was very upset earlier this year that I wasn't invited.
I added you.
Yeah, but I had to ask.
Also, Zoe, I'm pretty sure you immediately said, that's it, we need to start a subgroup now that the old guys have
exactly.
started.
Yeah. So, grizzled, maybe I am grizzled.
But, Jamie, in any case, let's get on to your segment.
Yes.
What have you got for us today?
Okay, so earlier this summer, before Meghna departed our lovely show for a longer, different show, we went out in the field to this new restaurant that opened in Boston. It's called Spice, and we had a blast. It's a robot restaurant where robots make your food, and we had fun going out there, and the piece you'll hear in a bit was fun, and the food was not that great. Spoiler alert.
Though I have to tell you, my son, who is 14, has been insisting we go back there ever since he listened to this piece. About
Did you go?
We haven't got there yet, but I promised him next week.
Okay. All right. There you go. In the new year, New Year's resolution, go to Spice Restaurant. Well, you know, try it out. Maybe the food has gotten better since that very first day when we went. But so for me, this piece has like so many things.
Don't make this mistake at home.
Please don't ever do this. So I had so much fun with this with Meghna. It was collaboration. You guys all helped to make it happen, give us the time and space to go out there and sort of co-host this visit to Spice Restaurant. But in the heat of the moment, free range, no script.
Freewheeling.
I'm talking to the guy.
Don't try this at home.
I somehow thought it would make sense to go after my own mother's tomato sauce. And I'm Italian American.
I was just gonna say your Italian mother.
It's like it was just sacrilegious and awful. And I was trying to make a point about the importance of food and family and humans in food, and instead I just dissed my mother, and I'm still hearing about it today. And I'm truly sorry, Mom, if you're listening. That wasn't what I was trying to say. I was trying to defend humans, and so I'm sorry.
Though, of course, I want to say, you know, what is it that Shakespeare says in Lear? How sharper than a serpent's tooth is the ungrateful child.
Guys, we went all the way to the CSEG before he quoted Shakespeare.
Oh, that's great for everybody, really.
Jamie, we had a segment about Shakespeare.
We did.
He quoted Shakespeare.
And now, listeners, you know why they don't let me behind the mic too often. Sorry. Go on, Jamie.
But, okay, so I'm going to bring you this piece. I'm also going to say, through the magic of editing, my offensive comment is gone from this version.
Oh, Jamie.
So there's no need to continue immortalizing this moment of my life.
It's
like gone. I got rid of it.
It's mom safe.
So here's the piece. And the first voice we hear from is Michael Farid. He's the CEO of Spice, talking to Meghna Chakrabarty and me on opening day.
That's the first bowl.
That's the first bowl. So it's right over here.
So there aren't futuristic robot chefs here that have swapped toques for cybernetic control systems. Spice features 7 automatic mixing and cooking bowls that spin and heat up fresh ingredients.
And it's kind of mesmerizing to watch as an orange ingredient delivery system slides back and forth above each one of the woks.
That orange box, we call that the runner. That's sort of what collects the different ingredients for your meal, and it delivers them to one of the cooking woks. What you see over here, the seven cooking woks, that's what sort of cooks, mixes, and sears your meal.
Right behind you, Marcos.
All right, so where am I? All right, so what you're listening to here, that's the sound of our chicken and rice searing and sizzling in the robotic wok. Coming over this way a little bit, we're looking at the chicken and rice is about to end, so the contents just tilted down into the bowl. Oh, wow. The bowl is going to swivel back out, and then you're going to hear the sound of the wash over here. So that's sort of, it's kind of like a steam wash. It's a high-pressure hot water, gets all the particulate off and gets it ready for the next meal. It also sanitizes it, so it's nice and clean after.
The robot cooks and cleans. I'm kind of loving this. So maybe it's not surprising that Farid and his co-founders are graduates of MIT.
We were in college, myself and my co-founders. We were at MIT, and we felt that we couldn't get a delicious, healthy meal at anything less than, say, $10 or $12. Obviously, we were, as engineers, this was the solution that we thought of.
So, I'm Italian-American. I love my mother's tomato sauce because it's made with love and care by a human being who matters to me. And so I'm curious how you're hoping to capture that love and human spirit that goes into food, that it matters to so many people.
I think that's a very valid question. I think that's part of the way we designed the experience. We recognize, firsthand that most people probably don't want to get their food from a mechanized system. And so you actually get your food with a smile from one of our garmagers. We have the robot really focus on what robots are good at. That's sort of the repetitive tasks, the hot tasks. Standing in front of a wok for hours is not, the most pleasant job to do. The garmagers focus on the customer service, and they focus on the hospitality aspect. And so you get a combination of the experience from the fun technology, but absolutely, the people are so important to the experience.
Jamie, let's be honest here for a second. The technology, it's new, it's cool.
And people at Spice on opening day loved watching the robot do its work.
But we walked outside because we had to get to the end of the line.
Which was going out the door.
And while we were waiting, you couldn't help it. Remember what you said?
I feel like I've partially seen our future. I don't know.
So when Stephanie V was getting her, we have to go outside now. The line's so long, it's like come outside
to
here.
Loop around to the other
end. Oh my gosh, Keytar Bear. Hello, Keytar Bear. What's up?
You never know what you're going to see in Boston.
Keytar Bear next to a robot restaurant. Perfect Boston moment.
I am struck by the juxtaposition of where we are, because there's Chipotle and a Clover. There's also a Starbucks across the way and a Dunkin' Donuts next door. I wonder how many other ways things will get automated.
It is hard not to think of all the food service employees that robots like this will replace. It's hard. So I'm going to play devil's advocate, Jamie, right now. And I'm thinking, he was making the point about how standing in front of a hot wok or a hot pan all day long, it's hard, greasy, uncomfortable work. So why not try to make that easier or remove that from what a human has to do? And as long as there's, now I'm not convincing myself anymore. As long as there are other jobs for that human.
I just want to say I haven't said anything so far in response.
Talking myself out of my own devil's advocacy.
But no, because I think, I don't actually think it's about today's restaurant. I think it's about tomorrow's restaurant.
Yes.
Well, and, he did say he wanted to bring the cost down from $12, but I don't know where the $12 bowls are.
Wait, but the bowls are still $7.50. That's the same price as a Chipotle bowl.
But maybe it's about bringing down the cost for them.
Well, yeah. Yeah, a taste test is going to really determine this, yeah. I think. Jamie, I really enjoyed that. Waxing philosophical with you about how there's no industry, seriously, that's immune to the effects of automation.
But, Magna, do you remember what happened when we finally got to the kiosks, that bank of touchscreens where you have to tap in your order?
Yes. The same thing that happens basically every time I use a CVS self-checkout machine.
It's okay, you hit cancel.
I just canceled.
No, okay. But not the whole thing.
It's not working.
All right, let me get help. A human being to the rescue.
Now, you see, I was expecting to not have to bother an actual person.
Oh, no, it's okay. That's what I'm here for.
Okay.
there was some issue with the payment.
And she tapped a couple of screens and fixed it.
Right, so then we waited along with this big crowd of people watching the robot deliver and heat and mix our food bowls.
Okay, so, do you see where it says your bowl?
No, I don't. No. It says ready to plate.
But, so there's a screen above every one of the robots saying now cooking bowl for whomever. Oh, hi, look. Jamie B.
And Meg, you see, we're completing cooking.
We're completing cooking.
It just plopped out, see? But so here's the thing. They've also figured out that like people will love seeing their name up on a board and take a picture of it.
And they were doing exactly that. Remember, Jamie? Like smartphone selfies with the restaurant robot.
But of course, as we've been saying, the real test is the food itself. So, Magna, we grabbed our bowls and we sat down next to Alicia Fay and Louis Baroa.
It's pretty cool that, like, we thought it was going to be more like robot servers or something like that, but that they're, like, actually cooking the food and dropping. And it's really cool how, like, you look up and it's like, hi, Alicia, and I'm cooking your meal, and you can see it rotating around in there. And then you're really surprised that it tastes really good because you're like, well, what do robots know about flavor?
Because I keep worrying about, like, what about the restaurant workers that the robots are replacing?
There's always place for human touch, you know what I mean? Like, you can't replace.
There's always a place for a human, yeah, because, I mean, there's definitely things that the robot.
Someone had to buy the ingredients. Someone had to put the stuff together, you know?
The humans are good, too, here.
Yeah, the human part is pretty nice. I mean, I came for the robots. I stayed for the humans, so.
Okay, Jamie.
All right, should we try this?
All right.
Magnacy.
You got the what?
I got the Thai bowl.
Okay, and I got the Indian bowl. It's like a robot hybridization of a classic Indian meal that you'd find in Mumbai. So they have tamarind and like crispy rice and these tiny little things called shave and raisins. And I mean, it's like Mumbai street food. All right, here I go. Gonna try it.
Oh no, your face is telling me everything, which no one else can see, but you're crinkling up your nose here. You didn't like it.
No, I didn't. I mean, it was just kind of, I don't know, a strange warm mixture of this kind of mishmashy set of curry flavors, Jamie. I mean, okay, let's just put it this way. My mom's food is not going to be replaced by a robot anytime soon. There is no fear of that.
Of course. And then I tried the Thai bowl, and your judgment was just as harsh. Here's what you said.
Like, it kind of tastes the same.
Yeah. I wonder if that's the challenge of a series of tubes splotting out ingredients and mixing them together.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fundamental challenge of any automation. The easiest, most straightforward way to automate anything is to make everything the same. I mean, Henry Ford knew that. You can have any color of car you want as long as it's black.
Right. And you can have any grain bowl you want as long as it's peanut curry.
As long as it's some, like, weird melange of, like, various Western interpretations of Asian flavors.
But, Meghna, the car analogy also means Henry Ford had it right.
Right, because today, cars made by both humans and robots,
they're everywhere right now, all over the world. So maybe one day restaurant robots will be too. So friends, coworkers here at this table, it was fun to do. It got us out in the city, and that's something I really want to be doing more of in 2019. As much as I love this table, would
and
love to get out
there.
We are
going to be doing more of that.
Looking forward to it. And Hitesh, you have to promise me that we will all not get replaced by robots in 2019.
Jamie. That is a promise I cannot make.
Does not compute.
Does not compute. No, of course. This show is the non-robot show.
At least for 2019.
Yeah, at least for 2019. No promises for the next year.
You know, what I loved about that piece is when I was a new American, I used to watch this sitcom called The Jetsons, which I'm sure everyone knows, and all the food just popped out of machines.
Yeah.
Maybe the reality wasn't so good. But imagined future is never quite.
Does anyone really want to eat food that is plopped, splopped, or popped out of
I was noticing some of your series of tubes
but
type
that's
language.
What it, that's
where,
what it was. Yeah. And it, just,
and it doesn't really beat just having a homemade meal like served right up to you.
Yeah,
by
made by your mother.
Mother.
It's delicious.
Jamie Bologna
that's
learned.
Delicious.
See what you did there,
there is
your mother who's cooking
like
is unmatched.
Mom's cooking.
Oh, man.
Mom, Mrs. Bologna.
We want you to know that he loves you and he raves about your cooking. And he looks in the pink of health as a result. Jamie Bologna, everyone.
Thank you, Atesh. I'll send you a check later for that.
Everyone, any big lessons for today before we go out?
We have a great team.
We do.
You heard that reference to collaborative atmosphere, and I really think that is part of what makes this show so strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we keep it fun.
That's right.
And we have a lot in store for 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I decided that I would be the voice behind this is my tiny secret agenda. I wanted to acknowledge on air what an amazing group this is and what a privilege it is for me to come in every day to work with these people and to work on the things that we all care about, conversations with people about ideas and issues that really matter to this community. And that's what we're going to do in this coming year. And I'm so privileged to be able to do it with you and listeners for you. That's it. Producer's Picks done. Thank you for listening. Our show is produced by
Jamie Bologna,
Chris Siderick,
Paris Alston,
and Zoe Mitchell,
with help from our technical director, Tim Skog, and directing from behind the glass today, Eve Zukoff. I'm Hitesh Hathi. This is Radio Boston. Happy New Year.